Laura Kaziski got her poetry MFA in her home state at the University of Michigan, so she sees herself first as a poet, even though her 21 books are pretty evenly split between fiction and poetry. She was lured into novel writing simply because she loved reading them.
In my late 20s, I had a summer off, and I thought, okay, I'm going to write a draft of a novel, and I did. And then I got addicted to that.
The writing world of Laura Kaziski, ahead on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. As a writer, Laura Kaziski's many honors range from a National Book Critics Circle Award for her 2011 poetry collection, Space in Chains, to an Independent Publisher Book Award for her 10th fiction book, her debut short story collection, If a Stranger Approaches You. Three of her novels have been made into films, The Life Before Her Eyes, White Bird in a Blizzard, and her first novel, Suspicious River, which we talked about along with her early poetry in 2006. We got together again when she returned to Kansas City as the 2018 Cockafair Chair Writer in Residence at UMKC. In a recent episode, we heard her read and talk about her poetry at the Kansas City Public Library. So in this studio interview, we focused on writing prose. Even though this author of 10 fiction books and now 11 poetry collections isn't concerned with finding balance between genres, her writing is more intuitively woven into her daily life. For her, writing novels is just fun.
It's writing, but it's not writing poetry. Those are very different processes for me. Writing novels uses a different part of my brain, uses different skills. I mean, I wouldn't say the process is relaxing in any way. It's stressful, but it's not as stressful as writing poetry for me because you don't get 300 pages written if you are working as hard as one does on a line of poetry. If you work that long on a sentence in a novel, you're going to have one really great sentence, and it's not a novel.
It is a real different activity, isn't it? I remember from our 2006 interview, we talked a little bit then about writing novels gave you more freedom because you knew where you were going to pick up the last time, whereas you were staring at a blank page often with poetry.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
You've churned out more novels since we last talked than you have books of poetry.
Have I? I don't.
Yeah.
No, I don't,
which is interesting.
I don't count them up.
You don't count them that way.
No.
Yeah. Three of your novels have been made into movies, which has to be financially a wonderful thing.
Yes. I'm not complaining about that.
You worked on the screenplay of one of them.
No, I never did.
Uh-uh. You never did.
No, I tried to work on a screenplay for something else once, and I'm a very bad screenplay writer.
Oh, that's interesting.
I know nothing about writing screenplay, and also all the things that I like to do or that I can do. I mean, not even just what I would prefer. I would love to write a screenplay. I think that would be highly rewarding, but, you know, I like to describe the weather. I like the kind of details that you don't need those for a screenplay. You need dialogue. You need
visuals,
yeah, but not described. So
visuals without the language necessarily.
Yeah. And really, I'm not a plot person. And as much as I love experimental film and, you know, all my favorite movies are somewhat strange and surreal and without plots, I do understand that that's an unusual taste. And even I, too, have an idea in my mind about what a plot should be. I mean, when you read a novel, I can be very much seduced by the language and intrigued by the characters. And if the plot is not tight, I'm totally willing to let that go. However, an hour and a half long film, there's really no conflict. No conflict gets resolved. I, too, think, oh, plot's important.
it's such a different medium.
It is.
Well, I feel like you're fairly prolific. I mean, with your poetry and your novels and your book of short stories, If a Stranger Approaches You. Now, this is your first collection of short stories. Your only collection. Am I right, or have you done things kind of backwards? I mean, you were a poet who slipped into novel writing, and now this long in your career, you're finally coming out with short stories, which is usually you think of writers in the beginning writing short stories and then branching out into novels. Tell me about the impetus for If a Stranger Approaches You.
Well, I had written short stories when I was in my 20s, and they were not, to put it bluntly, they weren't good short stories. So over the years, I had felt inspired to write something in prose, but that would not turn into a novel. And I write quite a lot. I write every day. And so I had gathered up, you know, several hundred pages of little stories. And so I put them together. Sarah Band, the press, was very supportive too, and had actually solicited and said, do you write short stories? Do you have a collection? And that inspired me to weed out and, you know, arrange them. So I've been writing them a little bit all the time. I mean, sometimes there were things that were going to be poems, and once in a while I'd just have an idea for something that could be a story.
Some of the stories in this book really are developed in images. You know, I'm thinking of the second one in the collection that has to do with a statue called Memorial.
Yeah.
It felt very poem-like to me in some ways. I think I'm going to have you read Memorial. It's one of the shorter ones.
Memorial. There was a park at the center of a small town. In it, there was a memorial to the children who had been burned and killed in the town fire 100 years before. Their names were chiseled onto the base of a statue of an angel who was kneeling in the grass, looking weighted down by her own wings, as if those wings had fallen out of the sky as stone and attached themselves to an innocent woman's back. In memory of the children who died in the fire of 1902 was chiseled above a list of names at her feet. The children of the town who were alive and who played in the park 100 years later couldn't have cared less why the angel was there. They crawled on her and said, "Giddy up." They poked her blank, open eyes. They bounced a rubber ball off the side of her face, and no one blamed or chastised them. The people of the town were just happy to see the kids having a good time. But the angel, after a century of this, she grew tired. She had never even wanted to have children, let alone so many. Summers, the heat, the bugs, the rowdy picnics, the beer bottles and the Starbucks cups. Also winters, the loneliness, the snow. These things plagued and tested her, over which she had no control. She was a statue, doubled over, wings that did nothing but nail her firmly to the earth attached to her back, with a list of children's names at her feet, and only three things in her power. Stillness was one of them, attendance another, and the third power. The fire had been intentionally started in a warehouse at the edge of the small town in 1902 by an orphan who was tortured by memories of an abusive father who died, but also by the mother who'd slipped into another room and quietly closed the door when the boy was being beaten. She hanged herself in a barn after the father died. As the boy struck the first match, he believed that it was his father he was thinking of, getting even with. But as the warehouse went up, it was his mother's face he saw in flames, as the sleeves of his jacket melted into a new skin on his arms, a flammable skin, so that when he ran from the warehouse, his arms were fiery, flapping things in the road. And, of course, into the wind, which blew the sparks of him and the warehouse into one house after another through that town, which was still made of wood back then. The children were in their beds, and their parents slept soundly. Being born had come so easily to those children, water filling a cup. But death, well, a lucky few never stirred from their childhood dreams of animal chaos, impetuous toys, confused worlds in which puddles, stomped, would fill up with fish. Those children could continue their strange dreams forever. But others suffered, choked, writhed, called out to their mothers, became dark screaming offerings to the screaming darkness. Of course, adults died in the fire of 1902 too, but they had a statue of their own in the cemetery down the road. Another angel, male, stood upright with a spear and very few duties, and with no fear of time, which moved across the town and the whole world slowly but relentlessly, devouring everything. That angel's burdens were nothing like the burdens of the angel in the park, who was in memory of the children. Because, of course, who rescues a child whose mother doesn't hear its cries? Who loves a dead child after its mother has died? Who protects the memory of a child or a child without a mother? In the blasting sun, in the dark of night, in the rain, under the moon, and as the snow is falling? That was her third power. The old man who'd made the angel and had chiseled the names on the plaque at her feet had seen to that. Without this power, she had no others. It was the most amazing power of the three. It was the power that granted the others, the power to forget about them entirely, to love them or not, to stand by, walk away, close a door, die. Every day, the angel faced this third power, faced it with the dawn as the pigeons stomped across her shoulders and as the drunks gathered up their paper bags with bottles, as the dogs came sniffing around. Every night, she held her vigil, pondering this power beneath the clouds or the stars or the vaporous brilliance of Venus or the hard, bright spear point of Mars, as the lovers wandered through the park and as the dead children crept out of the memories where they'd been hiding and gathered around her in the dark.
That's the story Memorial. It's from the collection If a Stranger Approaches You by Laura Kaziski, and it was also the winner of the 2014 Independent Publisher Book Award for Short Stories, which is kind of exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, by Sarah Band Books, who published it. That was a great reading.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I don't remember writing that story.
Oh, are you
serious?
It's kind
of creepy.
Oh,
that's... No, I really don't.
Yeah. Well, it's so vivid because you can see the park, but I love the way you bring the statues to life, and not much of a life, no. But a life nevertheless.
Yeah.
It seems like you often are dealing with children who have had things taken away from them on some level. And that seems to come up again and again in your writing.
Yeah, it takes another person, I think, not the writer, to be able to see things like that. I don't.
You're not conscious of it, which
no,
is.
No, I don't have that, you know, distance with which to say, oh, this is what I'm writing about. Sometimes I know because I'll start to write a poem or even a novel and I'll think, oh man, I just wrote this or I've written this one 10 times. Or can't you ever write about something else, Laura? Does it always have to be mothers and daughters and yeah. teenagers and conflict with their parents? So I do know what some of my go-to themes are, but otherwise, I wouldn't be able to make an observation like that.
You just engage yourself in what you're writing at the time.
Yeah.
And it just becomes the world that you're in. I wanted to know if you find that shaping a short story is at all akin to poetry.
I do, but I would say as well that there are a lot of people with very informed ideas about the form of a story and what it should be. And I think because I did not study fiction writing and I didn't internalize any of those ideas, that my stories, they're poets' stories, basically. I think they were written very much with the same impulse that I have with a poem, less about plot. I mean, almost never about plot, more narrative than my poetry would be. But certainly Aristotle wouldn't approve of my, you know, there's no five steps of plot there. And I often have conflicts that are not resolved. Or so I feel a little bit more that they are poems, sometimes in prose, rather than, you know, conforming to some really excellent ideas about what a short story would be. I'm not saying that I could just cast off all the rules and all the traditions, but I'm writing a different kind of short story.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Well, in the beginning of this collection of short stories, If a Stranger Approaches You, you have For Antonia Nelson, Best Storyteller and Friend in the World.
Yeah.
And I read elsewhere that you've known each other for a quarter of a century. How did you guys meet?
We were at Breadloaf. We were roommates. We had never met before. And then we were in twin beds, 5 feet away from each other. And luckily, we really liked each other because otherwise, we would not have been friends. I would say, too, that a lot of us in the world think of Toni as our really, really good friend. She has a gift for friendship.
Well, I wondered how much of a mentor, because she writes stories herself, how much of a mentor she was with this book at all. Was she?
Well, I don't share my writing very much, you know, until I feel like it's done. She's in my mind. When I'm revising, I'll have her in my mind and think of, oh, if Toni's reading this, what would she think of it? But no, she definitely read and made suggestions, has several times on novels that I've written, but I've become the kind of writer where if I can't do it or if I feel like I can see what's wrong and if I can't fix it, nobody's suggestions can help, you know. So I really don't go to other people for feedback much anymore. My husband, you know, but he's the captive audience.
Well, Antonia Nelson was here in the same position that you are.
Uh-huh,
she was the Cockafair Chair Writer in Residence. That's neat. So how often do you see each other now?
We try at least, you know, a couple times or a few times a year, sometimes more, sometimes less. The last few years, we've always done a conference together in Michigan, the Bear River Writers Conference.
Oh, I've heard of that. Yeah.
But otherwise, you know, we meet up where we can, when we can. So,
yeah. I think I'm going to have you read another short story from If a Stranger Approaches You, You're Going to Die. Talk a little bit about the story before you start to read it. Or can you remember this one? You didn't remember writing the other one.
I do remember writing it and that I had intended for it to be a longer story. However, I felt that it was a conflict that could not be resolved. When I got to what ended up being the ending, after thinking it would be a longer story, I just knew. I was like, oh, that's the end. That's all there is to be said here.
I thought it was a great ending, actually.
Oh, thank you. So, I hope so.
Yeah.
You're going to die. Their father had only a short time, as the doctors put it, and it had fallen to the eldest daughter to tell him this. He would want to know, the other three of his children said with certainty, and he'd want to hear it from you. And then they went back to their lives. She would take him out in the boat, she thought. On the river, she would row. He could lean back and watch the sky, watch the clouds slip around in it like afterthoughts. Never the same cloud twice. Soft craters, calm bombs, floating, dispersing, reanimating and reforming. Surely this was the place to do it. Here the news would seem less personal. Cosmic news, a part of the cycle of this life. There in the boat, with his eldest daughter, his hand in hers. You're going to die, she would say, and he would nod, staring up into the blue inevitability of the sky. But that morning when she picked him up, he looked fantastic. His hair was combed, and there was color in his cheeks. He was wearing a cap and a tweed jacket like some father out of a Russian fairy tale, not like her father. She found herself peering around him as if for the ragged old man she'd expected and glimpsed the little foreign nurse's aide slipping out of his room like a ripple or a giggle, wearing white. The aide's name was something decorated with accent marks and vowels that made the opposite of the sound they ordinarily made, as if the name had been conceived as a way to shame her own plain name, Jane. When that aide had to speak to Jane, she called her Mrs., although Jane had never married. Jane's father had a handkerchief folded into an arrowhead in his pocket this morning. Had the aide done this for him? It was embroidered with initials Jane didn't recognize, not his own initials. His pants looked pressed. Perhaps he'd put on a bit of weight. He called goodbye to his aide, who called back to him in a language Jane didn't speak and her father didn't speak, but which he seemed to understand. You're going to die. Daddy, Jane said, you're going to be too hot in that jacket. You should leave it in the car. He looked at her blankly, and then he shrugged, as if he were the tracks shrugging off the train, as if he were the hero of a tale shrugging off his fate. He kept the jacket. Jane started the car and drove in the direction of the canoe livery, listening to her car's little alarm bell chime the whole way because her father wouldn't buckle his seatbelt. She'd considered sitting in the parking lot of the retirement home with him until he agreed to let her fasten it, but then she reminded herself that he was going to die. What did it matter? And how much longer would she need to listen to that bell chiming as she drove her stubborn father places anyway? When she started the car without starting the old argument, she was quite sure she saw in the passenger window the reflection of his smile. He'd won an argument without even having to have it, an art he'd perfected in the course of his life. When they came to a stop at a red light, Jane turned to look at him. Seatbelt warning chiming between them, seatbelt light flashing on the dashboard in front of her, and he was definitely smiling, and he was wearing that jacket and looking like a man in perfect health, as pleased with himself as ever, the same guy who'd greeted her every morning when she was a teenager by crowing, "Hey there, somebody took her ugly pills again this morning." The same guy who'd unwrapped every Christmas present she'd ever agonized over before buying and setting it down on the floor at his feet, never to speak of it again. "What's your problem?" he asked her. In the corner of her eye, Jane saw that the traffic light had turned green, but there were no other drivers around, and they were certainly in no hurry. She made no effort to step on the gas and pass through the intersection. "Huh, what's with you? Forget how to drive? Waiting for the light to turn a little greener? Take too many stupid pills this morning?" Jane didn't swallow. She didn't even take a deep breath. She said, "You're going to die."
That's the story, "You Are Going to Die," from If a Stranger Approaches You by Laura Kosciuszko. This book was the winner of the Independent Publisher Book Award for Short Stories in 2014, and the book is from Saraband Books.
I stole that line about the ugly pills from Antonia Nelson.
Really?
Yeah. I won't go into the details about it, but she knew someone who would ask such a thing. I don't know if it's in any of her stories, but it's an anecdote she told me. So,
well, with your poetry and your novels, are you working on them simultaneously? I mean, do you put one down when you get frustrated with it and pick something else up? Or how do you balance that in your life?
Well, really, there's no balance, and I don't necessarily need balance. Once in a while, if I'm really at the very last stages of writing a novel or deeply involved in revising it so that whatever time I have for writing, I have to devote for that or I'm going to lose the thread, then I won't even think about poetry. But otherwise, I mean, I don't write poems every day. I mean, it's best for everyone that I don't. I think I want to have a lot in a poem, not just a little. And so, you know, I keep notebooks. I jot things down. I go back to those and I pick some of it up. Some of it's just jottings in a notebook, but I pick some of it up for poems. But poems, just because I've been doing this for so long, have become a habit. I just know there's something in my brain or my lifestyle that just tells me every once in a while, oh, you might have a poem to write now. And it's not really a matter of I write a chapter of a novel and then I can focus on poetry for a month. I don't do that. It's no different than anything else. I also do laundry. You know, but it's not a matter of balancing it. It's not like I can only do laundry or I can only write a novel. So,
right,
luckily
right.
For everyone. So, although I would like to claim that and have somebody else do all the chores. So,
you know, I was intrigued by something you said to the fiction writing class here at UMKC that you were teaching. You told the students that when you start out on a novel, that you have to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, so that you kind of know what to aim for. So does that ever change for you in the process of writing? Does the end ever become something else? Or?
Oh, definitely. I didn't mean exactly that before I start a novel, I have to have an idea for a beginning, middle, and an end, but that I have to draft a beginning, a middle, and an end so that I can go back and revise.
Oh, so that's what you start. You start writing.
Right. I start writing. And there have been only maybe two novels that I've written that I knew the ending of before I began. Most of them, I don't even know what they're about. You know, anything when I start, it's like reading. I'm just sort of figuring it out as I'm writing it, which makes for a very sloppy first draft usually. But I don't know why my most recent novel, I just knew the end. I just woke up one morning and I knew what was going to happen.
That's Mind of Winter?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then my second novel, White Bird and a Blizzard, based on a true story. So I knew the ending of that one.
Is that the one you sat down and just wrote it straight through fast? Which one was that?
My first
novel. Suspicious
also
River.
Mind of Winter, I wrote very quickly.
Yeah.
And again, I think I just sort of had the whole idea of it in my mind, and it was
that
more a matter
feel
of,
like a gift.
Oh, it feels like such a gift, and it doesn't happen
right.
very often. And I think that's why I've been struggling with the one I've been writing for the last 4 years since that, because I keep waiting for that gift to come. When's Santa coming back with that, you know, vision? But then I'm having to do this one as I've written other novels where I keep sort of developing, you know, I think I'm moving forward. I think I know where I'm going, but I'm not really sure. And it has not flowed forth, you know, in any kind of magical, supernatural way.
It's
work.
It is work. Well, I noticed that one of the people that you thanked, I think it was in Where Now, was Tony Hoagland.
Yes.
And he recently passed away. Yeah. Young. He was only 64. I was so shocked. Do you know what he died of?
Yeah, he had pancreatic cancer.
Oh, pancreatic cancer. Yeah.
He lived with it for three years.
That's a long time.
It is. He was in remission for a little while. So
yeah.
We always lived across the country from each other. So I only saw him a couple times a year at conferences and that sort of thing. But he was truly my first friend I ever made just through poetry. When I was in my 20s, I think he's older than I am, but we started sending each other sort of fan letters through the mail, and we wrote to each other for maybe 10 years before I ever met him in person. So.
Oh, wow.
And then we worked together at Warren Wilson. But his poetry especially, it's kind of one of those things where I really liked Tony, too, and enjoyed his company. But the writing of poetry seems even more meaningful because his poems, they're still here.
Mm-hmm.
I wish he was here to write some more. As Michelle Boisseau, who I met here, and the shock of her not being here either. But
that's right.
You know, I was thinking of her, been looking at some of her poems too, which we still have those.
That's right.
It's not the same. And I wish she was here to write more poems.
I do too. Well, Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Laura Kaczynski, UMKC's 2018 Cockafair Chair Writer in Residence. We heard her read from If a Stranger Approaches You, published by Saraband Books and winner of a 2014 Independent Publisher Book Award for short stories. If you missed the earlier episode featuring her poetry, you can hear that on our website, newletters.org. The number of her poetry books has pulled ahead again with her 2019 publication from Willow Springs Press called The Time Machine, though she does have another novel in the offing. If you enjoy hearing about creative writers, please consider making a contribution to our operation. The Support New Letters button is in the top right corner of our website. That's newletters.org. To keep up with our activities, you can follow us on Facebook. We're also on Tumblr, Twitter, and Instagram. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine, published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with Ashley Cote, Robert Zimmerman, Natalie Stein, Anna Stokes, Evan Lohman, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.